Thanks for the lovely introduction, Mark. I was, you know, when I was thinking about Valentine's Day, love, romance, I was trying to think of what of my work I could possibly bring to read. And so what I've managed is, I've been writing some short shorts recently, and what I can manage for you is one about marriage and one about love, but not in the same piece. This is a series of fake urban legends that I've been writing, and I'm just going to read a couple of these. The first one is called The Tilted Building. As everyone knows, the streets of New York are hollow. Their paving is the shell of a dark egg. When you walk along them, you hear your steps echo in the city's smoky inner cavity, where fires that eat up the evidence of unsolved crimes are kept burning by workers who've grown allergic to sunlight and slightly translucent over the years. It has been this way since the earliest days of European incursions into the New World, when Dutch settlers first hollowed out Manhattan Island's interior to store contraband, liquor, and slaves en route to the Caribbean. Sometimes, at night, a hole will crack open in the crust and buildings will begin to sink towards it. This really does come around to being about marriage, I promise. Because the buildings are so tall and close together, they almost never fall. They tilt inward until the upper stories touch, then they rest propped against each other as though they were kissing or telling each other a secret. Their residents slide down the floor to one end of their apartments in their sleep. They wake up pressed against a wall, crushed beneath their own books and furniture and houseplants. As they fight to free themselves, they often find things that they thought they'd lost years ago, but which were really only buried in the sediment of their possessions. In the morning, workmen from the city come and set these buildings upright again as though nothing had ever happened. Once, in summer, a man had left his window open because of the hot weather when his building shuddered, creaked, and began to tip over. There are several different versions of this story. They do not agree about the man's age or race or name, but they all tell how he rolled out the open window and onto the fire escape before he even knew what was happening. He woke up just as he tipped over the edge of the metal balcony and out into space. He managed to grab the railing as he fell and hold on, his legs dangling down towards the street. He shouted at the top of his lungs for help. His wife heard him shouting. She had been in the other room when the building began to tip over. She suffered from insomnia and often stayed up reading long after the man went to bed. At first, she didn't respond because he was the sort of man who shouted often and made a fuss out of proportion to its cause, and she hoped that he'd stop and she could go back to reading her book. In truth, theirs was not a good marriage. They didn't get along well enough to be happy or badly enough to divorce. After several minutes, the man was still shouting, his cries growing more urgent and panicked, so his wife put aside her book and slid down the floor of their apartment and into the bedroom. She slid over to the open window. She looked out at him hanging from the fire escape by his hands. She folded her arms and shook her head. He shouted at her, "Don't just stand there, do something." She sighed and went to get one of their bedsheets with which to rescue him. But back at the window again, she stopped and looked at him, considering. Had he been a good husband? Had he been a good man? He was a tax assessor for the city, although in one version of the story originating in Queens, he owned a check-cashing franchise. He liked to go golfing and to the movies. He liked to read books about true crime. He was a decent cook, although he only made dishes containing chicken. When he traveled, he always brought something back for her, a spangled elephant statuette or earrings or a scarf. Occasionally, he made her laugh. On the other hand, he often smelled bad in the morning, some indefinable combination of cinnamon and disinfectant and cheese. He'd hit her once early in their marriage, and though he never did it again, when he was angry, he would tell her she was stupid. He was angry quite often. She did not like that they disagreed about something. He did not like it when they disagreed about something, even something trivial, and his voice would take on a flinty, imperious tone when she begged to differ. Also, she'd never much liked chicken. Should she rescue him? His fingers were slipping, losing their hold on the metal rail, and still she could not make up her mind. This is called The Last Video Game. Robert Knelson Pritkopf, the man widely credited as the inventor of the video game, was apparently a lonely child. His parents died in a plane crash when he was young and he had no siblings. He was raised from the age of five by his maternal aunt, who lived in a suburb of Phoenix. A self-absorbed and bitter woman, Pritkopf's aunt resented her nephew, whom she regarded as a burden and an idiot. The evidence suggests that she was alcoholic and she alternated between neglect and abuse. According to Pritkopf's ex-wife, she used to leave him at home alone for days at a time without sufficient food and without supervision of any kind. You know what? Not for a Valentine's Day reading. It gets worse. Okay. All right, we'll do a love story now. This is called Surgery, a Love Story. For a while in Hollywood, it was fashionable for actresses to have sections of their nervous systems removed. The idea behind the surgery was this: because the nervous system is what makes us react to the world, wrinkle and crease our faces, flinch, frown, and grin, its removal would retard the aging process, if not prevent its physical effects altogether. Unfortunately, there were side effects and unforeseen consequences to the surgery. Without their nerves, these women burned and cut themselves without realizing they were doing it. They fell and didn't feel it. One woman walked around her house on a broken leg for 3 days without noticing she was injured. After this incident, the surgery was outlawed, but it was too late for those who'd undergone it already. They would live with the consequences for life, which included numbness in the affected areas, lack of coordination, and loss of reflex response. In Malibu, there lived a beautiful old woman without a nervous system. She had been an actress when she was young, and she'd starred in a few films and had some small parts on TV. Her agent had encouraged her to get the neuron readjustment therapy, as it was then called, and she'd thought it would give her more time to become a star. In fact, after the surgery, her face on film looked oddly immobile, as though someone was configuring its expressions by remote control, and as a result, her career dwindled, then fizzled out. She was offered fewer and fewer roles, then none at all. Still, she remembered the parts she had played fondly. In her most famous role, she'd played a beautiful woman who watched and gasped and sighed while the hero of the film first saved a small boy from drowning and then saved the boy's entire village from evil priests with shaved heads and strange tattoos. The film was set on a Pacific island. In the end of the film, the hero kissed the woman on a beach and then went away to war while the woman and the boy whom the hero had saved from drowning waved to him from the end of a pier. From the sad music that played, the woman knew that the hero was never coming back. That was years ago. Now she lived in an undulating house of white, uncertain rooms with a long lawn below it that ended in a cliff above the ocean. Mostly, she didn't miss her nervous system, though she had to be careful and have her maid check her for injuries every few days in case she'd hurt herself. She led a quiet life. She ate a diet of jellyfish with the stings removed. They were spongy and tasted like glue. She drank seawater with lemon juice. She swam in her pool. She worried about the sun exploding one day in the future and about whether talking on the telephone spread diseases. Things continued this way for years until one day a man broke into her house by climbing over the high wall that surrounded it. The woman herself found him when she was watering her garden. He was crouching in the bushes near her swimming pool, watching her with big, scared eyes. He seemed familiar to her, though she couldn't think of where she'd seen him before. He stood up and she thought about whether to scream or not as he stepped out of the shrubbery and came towards her. For some reason, she didn't scream or run away. She just watched him approach. He stopped when he was standing only a few feet away from her. He said, "I won't hurt you if you give me that necklace you are wearing." The woman put her hand up to her throat and felt the pendant that hung there. It had been a present from the man who'd played the hero in the movie she'd been in, and she didn't want to give it up. She said to the man, "I can give you something else more valuable, but not this." She looked at his clothing to see if he might be armed, but he didn't seem to be carrying a gun. He said, "No, I want the necklace," and he lunged for it. The woman turned her garden hose on him and sprayed water in his face, which stopped him for just long enough so that she could start to run. She started running up the hill towards her house, but she couldn't go very fast because she had to be careful not to damage her numb feet and legs. She glanced back over her shoulder to see if the man was coming after her, and she saw that he was, but not very quickly. He was also running in that slow, ungainly way of a person who could not feel his own feet. She was so surprised by this, she had never seen a man with her condition, that she forgot to be afraid. She turned around and watched the man struggle up the slope. He seemed even more familiar to her than before. She said, "Who are you? Where do I know you from? If you tell me, I'll give you the necklace." The man stopped running. He said, "I was the boy in the film whose village your lover saved. I got this surgery because my agent told me it would make me more handsome. Now I can't do anything. I can't even work a regular job because I'm too clumsy." "I've loved you since I was a child," he said. "Even then, I wanted you to stop ignoring me, and I wanted to touch your beautiful round stomach and run my fingers over the heft of your thighs." The woman looked at the man. She unclasped the necklace from around her throat and held it out towards him. He waved it away. He didn't even want it anymore. "I just wanted to see you again," he said. "I'm sorry if I scared you." He started to walk away up the hill. He looked defeated, walking with his head down, watching his feet to make sure he didn't twist an ankle. "Wait," she said, "please." He stopped. She came up the slope to where he was standing. "Did you have the whole thing removed?" she asked. "No. Did you?" "Well, I was meant to, but the surgery was not fully successful, so there are a few places where I can still feel things." "Where?" he asked. She reached out and touched his head, then his knee, then his chest. The ocean below went on crashing, flinging gulls into the air. "Come inside the house," she said. "I'll show you." Thank you.